Welcome to the local chapter of ISOC New York. We are honored tonight to have George Sadowski speak to us on the state of the Internet. George Sadowski is a pioneer member of the Internet Society since 1992, a member of the Board of Trustees, and the Vice President of Education. Thank you and welcome.
I know most of you. Now I know all of you. I had planned to be a little bit more formal in the presentation, but I don't think that's going to work here. So what I'm going to do is go through a bunch of material. I'll touch on the topic that I think I gave you in December, factors affecting the evolution of the Internet, because I think it's interesting to look at the whole panoply of what's happening in Internet space, and there's an enormous amount. And then I'd like to go to a couple of favorite topics and throw out some challenges for discussion. Some things I'm thinking about now, and I'm coming to conclusions that are somewhat different from the majority of the world, so I'd like to test them. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about this exciting space that we all live and play and work and suffer in from time to time. This space is changing at an alarming rate. I was at a Cisco seminar up at the Marriott this morning on content management. And I think Cisco calls it something else. That's what I remember. And the plans that they have for the integration of higher-level protocols and higher-level, it's not so much protocols, but management of the content space and the with essentially applications protocols is just amazing, and it reminds me how thick and how rapidly growing the developments in this space are. I'm not a futurist, and by the way, I am cobbling together talks that I've given in more immature forms in three other different places. At my age, I don't have a lot of RAM left, so I'm going to refer to notes from time to time. I can't do this extemporaneously anymore. When you talk about factors affecting the evolution of the Internet, you immediately are branded a futurist. I'm not a futurist. I distrust people who call themselves futurists. There are statements that futurists have made that have come back to haunt them, and I think Vint Cerf gave a bunch of them in his talk, which I was able to listen to, thanks to Jolly. The one about, for example, Bill Gates saying 640 kb should be enough for anyone. There are a whole bunch like that, and they are all they've all been proven wrong. We don't remember, for example, that Ed Yorden in 1999, Ed Yorden of structured programming fame, said the world is going to collapse as a result of the Y2K problem, and he built a house in the middle of rural Arizona, and you can imagine what that looks like. That was self-sufficient and all the rest. It's on the web. You can see it, and you can see his predictions. And, of course, the world didn't come to an end. More to the point, since Ed Yorden is considered a bit of a fanatic, Edward Yardini, who was the chief economist, I think, of Deutsche Bank, said, in effect, the same thing, that there would the probability of there being a major recession because of the Y2K problems was, I don't know, I think he said 70% or so. Well, 30% happened, and he still probably made the deciding economic policy for Deutsche Bank. So we got a lot of people running around who are amateur futurists. So I want to approach this as an economist and somebody interested in information and talk about demand and supply and network-related stuff. And one of the things that when I put this together that struck me was how much of an equilibrium there is and how certain things can tilt the balance. And it's amazing that we're on the path that we're on because it has probably a very low probability compared to all the other paths. So my sense is that the Internet has been successful until now because it has been a relatively simple construct in the sense that if you wanted to join the Internet, there were a certain number of interoperability rules you had to follow. We called them protocols. We referred to them as the TCP/IP family. There was distributed control over the net. Nobody had to argue who was president of the net. We could all join and maintain autonomy over various pieces of the net. That happens to be a significant thing, I think. That there were people guiding those initial years who weren't concerned about exploiting financially the net. They were R&E folks, you and I. by and large, and that the guiding institutions that came out of this, the IETF, the IAB, the Internet Society, were non-commercial and non-governmental. So there wasn't there weren't the major political fights that you have in governmental situations. In fact, there wasn't much to govern, according to most people. And there wasn't the race for market share, for financial dominance, for financial supremacy that we see more of now. Now, the current internet, well, we can characterize it. It's got,
I think I can name. I've said in the past that there is only one country in which the internet didn't exist. That there are more than that, but there aren't many. There's North Korea. There's Afghanistan. There's Iraq, I believe. There are probably some isolated islands in the South Pacific. That's it, I think. It's massively commercial. It has to be massively commercial in order to grow. That's one of the both fortunate and unfortunate parts about it. It's a very complex structure. There is no backbone. There's private peering all over the place. NSI claims last summer 400,000 new DNS registrations per week. It's an amazing number. We've gone from 1 to 80 registrars in a couple of years. That's the work of ICANN. And so it's big, it's massive, and yet it's not the whole network space, because if you think of the Internet as characterized by peer-to-peer TCP/IP, communication, AOL isn't in there. That's the biggest part that isn't in. In the past, UUCP, FidoNet, BitNet, they haven't been in there. And now there are some new services coming out that aren't in the Internet. The iMode in Japan, for example, which is a Docomo standard, soon, I think, to be an AT&T standard and to be watched very carefully, now has 15 million subscribers, and that's in the course of 18 to 20 months. And iMode is a way of getting essentially a pseudo-internet-like connection on your little screen. It has an interface to the internet. It has more limited capability, but it's wildly popular. So, is it going to invade? Are we going to have this much larger space of objects which interface with the internet, but in fact aren't the internet? And will it matter? Maybe it won't matter. So, let's talk about the effects that govern which way the internet's going. I categorize them the following way. There's supply push. There's things that make the internet more attractive, that make it that encourage people to use the internet. Then there's some supply weaknesses, and then there's some indeterminate issues. On the demand side, you've got the same. You've got demand pull, people finding new applications, invading new spaces, new uses. Then you've got some demand weaknesses, and then you've got some indeterminate stuff. So on the supply side, you have the fact that the cost of electronics continues to go down. Moore's law, twice the number of transistors on a chip at the same cost every 18 months, twice the power. It's interpreted in different ways, but basically it says every year and a half you get double what you got before. Okay, that's nice. And all the time when we talk about Moore's law, people can see about 10 years out. This is about the horizon for people who implement electronics. They can see the next generation because it's already in the experimental fabrication labs. They've already designed the generation after that, and they are optimistic enough to think they can go one step further, and after that it's all a big gray area. And that's the way it's been since 1960. Now eventually we're going to hit a limit, and the limit comes when we run out of elementary particles in the universe to conscript for these various things. There are about 10 to the 92nd of them, by the way, elementary particles, if you count all the protons, neutrons, electrons, plus or minus a few orders of magnitude. So that's the limit on the amount of storage that we're going to be able to have. That's the limit on a lot of things. And I don't think we're going to get there very soon, although there are interesting experiments in quantum computing that I don't claim to understand. That may have some effect on this, but not a practical effect. Okay, so you get these increasing returns to scale from the network. That's Metcalfe's law, saying that he says, and all of these are just expressions of laws, not laws, that you double the number of people on the network, you multiply the utility of it by four, because you've got more people to talk to, your markets are bigger, et cetera, et cetera. Then you have this massive movement of content to the web. 5 years ago, the web was touted as being a new thing, a good thing, but it wasn't clear at all that you had to be there. Now it's absolutely clear to most, almost all medium and large-sized businesses, not only in this country, but almost everywhere, that you've got to be there. And you've got to be there for a bunch of reasons, which are increasing over time. If you're a publisher, you realize you have to be there. Electronic publishing is a strong force. But and yet, when you look at the amount of content on the web today and the amount of content in the world, my guess is, and this is an uneducated guess, that we got about anywhere from 3 to 5% of the content of the world on the web now. There are some people at Berkeley who recently made an estimate of the amount of information on the web, and it was... I can't remember the numbers. It was enormous, and yet the amount of information in the world is far greater. Now, does it all have to go on the web? No. Will it all go on the web? No. But there's a lot more to come. The point is, we are still, even though this even though this looks like a plateau or mature growth, we're still in the initial stages of this thing. Then we got some training trickle down. The Internet Society workshops have trained now 2,500 people from almost every developing country. And those folks have gone back to their countries, and they have made major strides in bringing their countries online and in spreading the Internet in their countries. We got this rapid growth, practically an explosion in wireless devices. All this is encouraging more people to supply more information. We got the open source movement, which is bringing down prices. Linux, GNOME, Star Office, that's a factor in pushing supply out there. Here's more stuff. It's cheaper. You can use it in more places. Exploit it. Then we've got the growth, I think. This is a slower trend, but the growth in digital signatures and the expiration of the RSA patent will help that. Although the tools for digital signature and encryption don't seem to be coming along quite as fast as we would like. It's not a common thing now. It's still considered a bit of a mystery, and it's not clear how that's I'd say that's their slow growth. Then there's GPS, geographic positioning, coming way down in price, being built into cell phones by law here in this country, probably going into all kinds of wireless devices, even if the law doesn't require it, because the cost of the chips and the circuitry is going to go way down. The software will be developed. Markets will expand. And then also there's an interesting thing that I discovered in my last year at NYU, that in addition to people going on the Internet, devices are going on the Internet in a fairly large scale. There's something called BACnet, a set of protocols, which it's a control and automation network. The people here at NYU, for example, want to connect all their control apparatus over the Internet. This led me to have images of university wars where guys at MIT turn the heat up to 95 degrees in the room here, or turn it down below freezing. So we approached that with a little bit of a security concern. But it turns out that in every new room built on this campus, there are 17 sensors built in. I don't know what they're sensing, but they're sensing something. And they're, at the moment, they're passive sensors that send information to more active monitoring stations. But I'll bet that's going to change. So we got some supply weaknesses. We got longer-run pessimism regarding the persistence of Moore's law. We're getting down to micron widths that are increasingly difficult to produce using optical lithography techniques. So maybe we have 10 years. We got an unsolved problem of intellectual property protection, which means that you still can't put stuff out on the web and guarantee that you're going to get a return for the production of that intellectual property. Micropayment schemes, which in theory would solve that problem, have not been very successful. The cyber cash wallet is empty. And I don't think that there's any really successful micropayment scheme out there. This is unfortunate, because what we want to do is sell information on the net piece by piece. I want to pay a 2 cents for a stock quote or 5 cents for an article or something like that. And if there are a way of keeping the transactions cost down to a fraction of the cost, which you cannot do now, certainly not with charge cards, and do it automatically, then you have the potential for selling information in quanta that people want to buy it. We don't have it. So we got some indeterminate issues. I would say one is IP version 6, the explosion of addresses on the web, or on the net, excuse me. I'm falling prey to that. The fact is we're going to need IPv6. We're going to need it very quickly. We have cell phones wanting 150 million IP addresses. They're going to be building them into devices all over the place. Pretty soon you'll have 17 IP addresses in your walls of your new house. And it's tough to get there. There is a six bone, an IPv6 backbone that's been built, but there's a reluctance to move because we're all comfortable. We're still using private address space, and we're not caring so much about peer-to-peer relationships. And ultimately, that's going to come back and hurt us. Then, in terms of the international scene, Unicode continues to advance in its adoption, but oh so slowly. Unicode, for those of you who don't know, is a 16-bit code that incorporates to a reasonably successful extent all of the world's known character sets. And if it were in adoption everywhere, one could have documents which had any mix of any set of alphabets you wanted, and browsers that were Unicode compliant could render it in such a way that you could have multilingual documents that would be that would be readable anywhere. At the moment, we have, I think it's at least four standards for Chinese characters. There are a couple for Japanese. And the fact is that browsers here don't know about them, so even if you get Japanese text or Chinese text, you have to make some special arrangements to read it.
Mozilla is good at that.
Pardon me?
Netscape 4 doesn't, it just shows garbage on your screen.
Yeah.
But Mozilla does. I don't know where it gets the fonts from.
There are, for all I know, it's Netscape compliant. There are Netscape, Unicode compliant. There's a firm in Montreal, Alice Technologies, which has built a very nice Unicode compliant browser for quite a while. And so they exist, but they haven't entered the mainstream. Mozilla is there, and who uses it? 1% at most.
It's just a question of characters, right?
It's a question of the underlying codes.
Instead of 255 or whatever it is,
it's 65535. Yeah, exactly. And you've got well-defined rules for things like overstrikes and characters that are pieces of characters that hang off of characters, like in Thai, so on. And then you have agreed upon glyphs that get rendered when those codes enter the browser. It's been around since 1989, 1990. Microsoft's new products are 16-bit, can be put in 16-bit mode, and in theory can be used for Unicode-like documents, but I don't know enough to go beyond that. What I don't see is the emergence of true multilingual read-anywhere documents, so I don't think it's succeeded. Okay, so then there are a whole bunch of other things. There's the movement of high-tech labor between countries. Are we going to be able to get enough high-tech labor here to continue supplying these things? And what does that do to the countries which these folks leave? India has succeeded, and some other countries have succeeded in reversing this blow. Rather than sending the people here, they take the work there. That works really well. When you can do it well. And then there's the issue of quality of service on the internet, which is a major issue, which is very slowly being solved, very slowly being advanced, I would say. The fact is that the internet doesn't distinguish between high urgency packets and spam, and if we're going to, unless we're going to be able to saturate the world with bandwidth, then we're going to have we're not going to be able to implement applications which require low latency, such as voice over IP, in a reliable way, and others. Okay, so that's the supply side. On the demand side, there's apparently an insatiable demand for content. Everybody wants it. Everybody's getting on, sort of, although there seems to be a bit of a leveling off in this country. There are new applications. People learn to use new applications. They spend more time on applications. I see demand as sort of a fourth power: number of people, number of applications, intensity of use, and the fact is that applications are now beginning to spawn applications that you don't even see, interactions between agents that you precipitate, but work invisibly for you. And these are rudimentary at the moment, but there's no reason to that they're not going to get larger. Cisco is using agents very nicely in its content management plans, for example, and that's going to grow. So then you've got the personal imaging revolution, cameras, digital video. Is that digital video that you're taking? Yeah, right. See, you're going to be responsible for transmitting gigabytes of stuff on that alone.
Well, impressive.
Okay, it'll still be gigabytes. these are being sold increasingly. And now when I just got a digital camera, and I know when I send email when I go overseas, I'm going to send postcards. I'm not going to send text. So this is going to increase demand. There's some demand weaknesses. We are seeing an economic slowdown. This is probably the end to a long period of economic expansion. Will it pick up again? Probably. When? Who knows? In developing countries, there is tends to be a lack of resolve or money to make sustained attempts, successful attempts to spread the internet. I'll talk more about that later. There is an issue of taxation of goods and services, which is which governments still don't know how to deal with. But as the use of the net gets larger, you can bet that they're going to see that as more important, and they're going to do something. Whether they do the right thing or not is another matter. Then there's some indeterminate demand issues. How big is the home market finally? How quickly will it be developed? What will be the limits of its use? There's some evidence that this is leveling off in some homes. And, of course, there aren't more than 24 hours in a day. So will video on demand over the net be possible? Will it be popular? What will it do? What will the effects on congestion be? In the absence of effective QoS mechanisms, we know exactly what the effects on congestion will be. How quickly will... in this country, how quickly will local carriers decide that it's worth bringing fiber to the home so that, in effect, we have star networks replacing shared bandwidth and we're able to supply video on demand? What will that do to central switching structures? We don't know. We're going to increasing lengths to put huge files on the net as opposed to driving to Blockbusters and picking up a film. We'll ship a film over the net. What will that do to other forms of traffic? Do we want to make value judgments between forms of traffic, or do we want to just let the market decide? Do we want to cut out the folks? Well, I'll give you an example from NYU. Do we want to let Napster just go on and consume bandwidth, or do we care about the folks who are taking courses and need to get at course servers located on the other side of the net? That's important. Then what's going to be the next big breakthrough? What will be the son of web? There's going to be one. Maybe it'll be evolutionary. Maybe it'll be revolutionary. It's not clear. But every time you simplify, or every time you add applications and simplify interfaces, more people can join. So what is that going to do to demand? Will voice over IP? No, that's not true. So I was going to say, when will voice over IP eventually succeed? When will it succeed is the real answer, the real question. The answer is, in some places, very soon. In other places, later. What will be the determining effects? What will the telephone companies do in their anxiety attack when this begins to occur? How will they? Will there be retribution? And then finally, there are antitrust issues. What will be the effect of the final Microsoft judgment? Will the Bush administration back off from the remedies that were suggested by Justice? What would happen if Cisco were suspected of monopolizing a market? That's not impossible. Cisco adheres to IETF standards. IETF standards are open for everyone. But Cisco iOS, the operating system, is now such a major force in the field that it could be considered to be a monopolization of operating network operating system structure. Will Cisco iOS be forced to unbundle? Will it be forced to show its plug, to show its interface, its AUI, and to interface with other people who want to provide add-on modules? Not clear, but that's a possibility in the future. Okay, so there's all that, and you can see all the factors that affect how this thing is going to evolve, and how to predict one of them as being dominant, to try to understand where the net's going to be. You can make an educated guess, but I think that's the best we can do. I don't think any of us in 1990 would have predicted, or even 1995, would have predicted what we have today.
95, I think we could have done 1995.
95, we would have been closer to the mark.
Yeah, I mean, the web and everything was already off by then.
Yeah, but it was being poo-pooed. I mean, maybe you didn't poo-poo it, here it was considered to be...
I could see, you know, very much what's going on today, 94, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well,
the day they put NetCruiser out, that was when I think...
I didn't know NetCruiser.
That was a Netcom consumer web browser, integrated clients and everything that you could, you know, that was... You could just put it in your machine and you were away.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it was really it was compelling. It's true. I think we all realized that a change had been made, but I remember seeing the web very slow, somewhat cumbersome. JPEGs and GIFs were the best that we could do, images, and they were slow, and we tended to suppress them. I remember a guy named Ed Friedman, who worked at ACF, whom some of you know, who said this is great for text. but when you go beyond that, it's not very useful. Well, it wasn't in that environment. It sure is today. So now today we say that for full motion video. Okay, so that's all I really want to say about that, because I've taken probably 20-25 minutes. I want to talk a little bit about three issues. The first one is mostly a developing country issue. The second is a global issue, and the third is a governance, a way of looking at internet governance and internet administration. Does that make sense? Is that okay? I want to talk about the digital divide. It's a subject of great moral anguish at the moment, and almost everybody's talking about it. The G8. Had a special session on it in Okinawa in last July. The United Nations system is rising up against the digital divide. The Marco Foundation is committing lots of money and lots of effort. The World Bank has taken it upon themselves to join the G8 to help them understand and implement the measures to close the digital divide, et cetera, et cetera. And I want to pose the opposite point of view, that the words digital divide should at best be regarded as a gauge that one looks at occasionally, and at worst should be banished from the language. Let me give you the reason for that. I think we tend to see technology as a solution. For example, 5 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, we were talking about putting computers in the classroom. And in fact, after we got computers in the classroom, we talked about hooking them to the Internet. By and large, that is happening, and by and large, it has some salutary effects. But when we put computers in the dorm rooms here, they're used for Napster. They're not used for education. That's an oversimplification. But I think that the Internet has gravitated, as the market has pulled it, more toward entertainment, more toward casual use, and perhaps not quite as much as we would like, and that's a value judgment, toward the goals that we would like to see met. In the developing world, I would argue that we do not have a digital divide, that the concept really doesn't have meaning. What we have is all kinds of other divides. We have a divide with respect to opportunity for education. We have a divide with respect to adequacy of health care, ability to get health care, ability to get employment, meaningful employment. If all those divides were eliminated, there wouldn't be a digital divide. And what we ought to be talking about is, if anything, is some a phrase I don't particularly like, digital opportunities, digital empowerment, and so on, which is the bringing of information technology to those problems that in such a way that it can help to solve them. And it seems to me that's the appropriate way to look at this digital divide. And if we say, well, we close the digital divide, there's no point to that. We need to close these other divides, and we should use digital technology as well as using any other kind of technology or any other kind of non-technological means to solve it, to eliminating those divides as we can. So I pose that as an issue for discussion. That isn't to say we shouldn't try to influence the situation by doing things which, by their nature, like giving a rural health worker in a developing country an internet connection so he or she can look at what's happening in the rest of the world and get the National Library of Medicine, or the NIH bulletins, and so on. But we should do that as incidental to solving the larger problem and not focusing on the technology. Okay, so that's one point of potentially contention. The other thing I'd like to the second thing I'd like to talk about is distance education. It's a really important subject, and I have very, very mixed feelings about it, and I'd like to talk about them for a little while. First of all, distance education isn't new. We've had correspondence courses as long as we've had mail. Postal mail, that is. It may have been a pretty efficient way of doing business. The use of computer technology, information technology in education goes way back. Goes back to batch computers in the 50s, which were used for scientific and engineering instruction and some management games. The first computer that I know of that was explicitly used for education was the IBM 1500, which was a variant of the IBM 1130, which was kind of an interesting machine for those of you who like old machines. It was marketed by IBM, and it was test driven in Montgomery County and a few other places. It had it was the first relatively well adopted computer that had its own language, course writer for writing courses, but it was primarily programmed instruction, and it failed in the market. There were a variety of other efforts in the 70s, the biggest being Plato, the project by Donald Bitzer at the University of Illinois. That's where the plasma screen came from. He invented it. And the computer was a special computer where he, in fact, had a plasma screen with a rear-mounted slide projector. It was a huge project. Millions and millions of dollars and hundreds of hours of courseware were developed for it. Fairly specialized. I remember one on nursing education. I don't know whether you've probably seen some of the stuff that Bitzer's project did. One of the characteristics, however, that I think led it to failure, first of all, it was single platform, and the platform cost $10,000 at least. It was the figure that arose from it that killed it and haunts this field is that it took 100 hours of professional time to make 1 hour of classroom time, the 100-to-1 ratio. And that was to make a good hour, not a schlocky hour, but a good hour. That's a lot of time. But the fact is the project did this. They had courses. They graduated students from courses. But then the microcomputer emerged. Bitzer and the Plato project tried to make a transition to the IBM PC. That failed. In the beginning of the microcomputer era, there was a strong optimism that computer technology and the microcomputer would be very useful for education, would be not necessarily a panacea, but maybe it would be a quasi-panacea or something like that. There were lots of efforts to put educational material on the microcomputer. You may remember that IBM had its WISCware archive at the University of Wisconsin, and the University of Seattle or the University of Washington had the software archive. Apple did the same thing with Kinko's. And when all is said and done, if you look at the impact of those microcomputers on education, you find that they filled some very valuable niches in the area of productivity applications. There have been some very nice programs done. Mathematica, for example, was came out on the IBM PC. It's a commercial product, but it did a lot for calculus education. But by and large, these efforts have filled niches. And we always seem to have placed a little bit too much of faith in technology to solve the educational problem. And we don't need to look at computers for this. We can look back at television in the 1950s when television was reputed to be a quasi-panacea for solving educational problems. And look what happens when you turn on the television today. It's very useful in certain niche situations, but it doesn't come anywhere near to solving the grand problem. So, going back to microcomputers, I think there were some studies that I saw a while back that indicated that this 100-to-1 ratio tends to persist. Maybe it's not 100-to-1, but it's a lot of hours in preparation for 1 hour of classroom time. And what you have is an industry, the academic industry, the higher education industry, that isn't used to investing in that amount of time. And publishers will do it. They'll invest thousands of hours in editing a textbook because they'll sell tens of thousands of copies. When you have the academic production process, which consists of professors, and they do whatever they want, and we know that, and they can drop a project in midstream, and graduate students who are exploited while they're in graduate school, and they're good, high-quality labor, but there isn't a follow-through. What happens when you want to put out version 2? There's a lot of work. What happens when you want to go to a different platform, a different computer platform? There's a lot of work. So on and so forth. It's not tenable for addressing the mainstream of educational activity. Now, maybe we were stupid to think that any one solution ever was, but I think we did place a lot of faith in these things, and they generally let us down. And the question is distance education, or I prefer to call it network-assisted learning, is it different? How is it different? Is it going to be a niche technology or not? And I'm of two minds on this. Because what you have in web-enabled or internet-distributed network-assisted learning, whatever you want to call it, are a couple of new factors which may make a big difference. First of all, no more multiple platforms. You have a browser, and if you write things in a reasonable way, just about anybody can read it. Updating is not an issue. You don't have an inventory problem, because all the material is on your own server under your own control. There is no physical inventory. The time to change is very fast. Versions become meaningless because material can undergo more or less continuous change. That produces its own problems, but the problems are not nearly of the same difficulty as the ones dealing with the physical objects. Markets become global. Shipments become a thing of the past. So you have the possibility of millions and millions of people using your product. You have the possibility of major shifts in demand. If somebody says, look at this, it's great, you could have a million hits the next day. So the markets are very fluid. Things could also go the other way. So is that enough? We have global markets. And if we had Unicode, we'd have the possibility of multiple languages, delivery in multiple languages without too much of a problem. Can this succeed? And by the way, publishers are interested too, and it looks like alliances between publishers and academics are more likely to succeed in this environment than they are in previous environments, possibly because of that the barriers to entry are so much lower. So, will this work, or will it be a niche technology? The market results so far are mixed. First of all, every school wants to get into this game. And I think if you add up all of the projections of income by all of the schools that have announced that they're getting into this game, you probably come up with more than the total amount that's spent on education in the United States in a given year. That's a guess. There's a lot of optimism about this. There's a lot of hype. On the other hand, California State University System closed down its distance education program. the Western Governors University demand for their courses has been considerably lower than expected. If you've ever tried to go on the net and look at some of these courses, you get very mixed results. I was on with the Colorado Technical College, I'm not sure that's the name of it. Miller, do you know these people? CTC, ctc.edu. CTC.edu, Colorado Technical Consortium.
Yeah, I read about it. I haven't gone inside.
Well, they have a lot of courses, and they said, well, you know, you really ought to try these. They have four sample courses. Well, on my Mac, using Netscape 4.75, I couldn't get one of them to work. The other two displayed somewhat bizarre behavior, and one seemed okay, but pedagogically it just seemed very stilted. And none of them could have withstood the test of low bandwidth clients, the far distant clients in developing countries. So what do we got? It's quite possible that I'm a novice user of these things. I don't go out and search the web for them, but it's quite possible that they have a clientele. But where is the market for this? Is it big? Will competition be ruinous? Will, as some people predict, will there be one Economics 1 course in the country 10 years from now, taught by the best economics professor there is, and everybody will subscribe because it's so much better? Or will we break down into a lot of smaller efforts, none of which or few of which will be funded well enough or have enough persistence to be able to capture much market share? Not clear.
I have something. In the community meeting, I think it was Ted talked about, the main advantage for him of the web was that it changed how his students, that instead of just doing a project for themselves or for marks, that they could do it, they would do it and other people could read it. He could bring in parents and parents could form a review committee. And in fact, it made a different sense of learning because it was a collegiality.
Yeah.
And this, you know, and it's a greater point is that, you know, people think of the internet as a publishing medium, whereas in fact it's a communication medium.
That's a nice side effect. It's a major side effect of using the net. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. There's another side effect that I think will be really useful for the developing world, and that is that that this model perhaps emphasizes learning more than teaching, and the curious. The people who want to learn, assuming that they have access to the web, whether they go through a distance education course or whether they just surf and look and follow pointers and so on, the curious will really win in this game. And I think that's a major point because, well, even the United States, I was going to say the developing countries need to develop all of the skills they possibly have. We do too. We've got a lot of challenges in the world, but they do especially. And to the extent that latent interest or latent intelligence can be awoken by curiosity can be satisfied, I think they're well ahead of the game. And I look forward to a fair amount of payback from that effect.
I think one of the side effects of that issue is the politics of authority and upheaval in sort of social order. As I remember a while back, there was a very interesting article about developing nations where women were using sort of local crafts and selling them over the internet and doing very well. And it upset the established order of, you know, the local chieftain or the local guy in charge of the village, because then they had the money and they had the source of communication, which is a form of power. And all of a sudden, the guy in charge wasn't really the guy with the mm-hmm, power anymore. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then you've got the problem of women laying claim to economic power, and you're upsetting the social order of who owns the means of production, who owns the goods, who's buying and selling, who has the money. And so then you're talking about an entire social construct changing. And that also has the power to sort of rearrange the scheme of things unexpectedly. It's a side effect that people often don't think about. And it's very, in some ways, it's very, very good but in other ways it can also result in backlashes against the people who suddenly discover what a nifty mm-hmm. source of communication this is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it is in fact a way to change what has historically been difficult times or difference in the mm-hmm. way that resources mm-hmm. are used.
That's similar to issues where governments suddenly discover that their people have more information than they should have.
Exactly, than they want them to.
the facts in China, for example.
Exactly, and then suddenly you clamp down.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, what have we done? Well, what is this?
Yeah, communications was a good idea until it went too far.
Yeah, I think we're over that shock. I think the group...
I don't think so, though. I think there's a whole socio-political process that hasn't nearly...
Oh yeah. Okay.
Surfaced and begun to
Sorry.
Create unexpected shifts in politics.
Yes, I was thinking of the government of the national government level, but you're quite right. As this stuff penetrates down.
Yeah, I'm talking about what's happening really on a sub rosa level, you know, on a level that's beneath the radar. In some ways, that's a wonderful thing because I think an enormous amount of, for example, political organizing can occur beneath the surface so that by the time the government figures out that it's going on, for example,
mm-hmm.
you've accomplished a lot before mm-hmm. they find where your computer is and grab it. You know,
mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of that happens not just on a political level but on a social level or a communications level where, you know, if I take to the streets, then the guy with the club is there. You know, the government's there, the police is there, they can stop me much more quickly. But when it's below the sort of radar point, an enormous amount of communication can take place that people aren't really aware is there until it suddenly bursts forth or
mm-hmm.
blossoms
mm-hmm.
or suddenly becomes public
mm-hmm.
for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And that has its good points and its bad points. And I think that a lot of times there's this enormous amount of change that is happening in little pockets that people don't think about or haven't seen as a big picture. That really push forward on a regular person level.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
really important
because mm-hmm.
there's always this fantasy that everything is top down. I don't personally believe that technology happens that way. I think that's the preference, that's the hope, because that's the source of control. But everybody pushes technology forward or sideways
mm-hmm.
or in odd directions because of the very people who do it because they're interested.
You know, the Internet's certainly a good example of the fact that technology doesn't go top down.
No.
Governments might like it to go top down, but that's another matter. And what they have to learn is that's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. But people aren't counting that either. I mean, people can't... I think one of the really wonderful things about the Internet and about web access is that people that you were just describing, who are just interested, you know,
mm-hmm.
I'm interested in something and I want to know about it, let me go and look at what's out there. There's an enormous amount of information on pick the topic of your choice. And so there's all these people out there quietly self-educating.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's counting because they're not affiliated anywhere.
Right.
You know, they're not assigned to a school, they're not
right.
turning in a paper, they're just out there filling their heads.
And there the trick is to get them enough access
mm-hmm.
that they can do, so that enough people can do that. Yeah. Let me go on and finish this third topic because there's some...
Well, how's NYU's online education effort going? I remember they're making a big deal of that.
I can't comment on that because I have not been close to it. I know there's something called NYU Online, which is a commercial operation, and then there's SCPS, School of Continuing Professional Studies, which has its own online efforts. My sense is that they're both immature in the sense that they don't have a lot of courses, and they're just ramping up. Randy, where's Randy? He stepped out. I've retired from NYU. I'm no longer there, so I can't really tell you. Let me talk about internet governance. It's a big deal, and Rhonda Hauben unfortunately influenced it. You may think she influenced it positively. I think it was negative.
I had a glass of wine with her at one of the ASSOC meetings
mm-hmm.
a couple of years ago. And I remember her name because she was so intense.
Mm-hmm.
A great deal of sand. And I thought at the time, well, this is, you know, a credible view that she was expressing. I couldn't articulate that was some time ago. But she's a passionate person.
Yes, absolutely. Let's talk about the difference between administration and governance first, because I'd like to make that distinction. I think governments govern, and there are certain aspects of the way in which the internet's going to is evolving that governments are going to be concerned about, and rightly so. When people start engaging in criminal activity on the internet, governments are going to say, "We're the government. We're going to do something about it." What we do is another matter, but it's in their province. There are a whole bunch of things like that. There's the issue of the trademark law, which is it's a messy area. There's the issue of taxation. Governments have certain prerogatives, and we give them to governments as citizens and voters, and we expect them to fulfill those obligations. What most people talk about when they talk about internet governments is really internet administration. And the original administration of the internet was very informal. You administer your network, I administer mine. We agree on the rules of the road. We drive on the right, we stop on a red light, we go on a green light. Those are our protocols. And if we all agree on those protocols, we can join together. If we don't agree on those protocols, we're going to have colliding vehicles, and things aren't going to work. So the administration of the internet, which was seen to be a research administration task, went to an organization called IANA, Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, which was run out of the University of Southern California, largely by John Postel. That led, as the internet grew, to an unfortunate situation where the National Science Foundation, which was the executing agency for the internet up to about 1995, ceded its authority over. Did not cede its authority, but gave the task of assigning domain names under a contract to the NS. I've forgotten the name of it. Network Solutions in 1993, and Network Solutions promptly proceeded to build a monopoly. And as it became clear that the internet was increasingly important and the monopoly was contentious for a variety of reasons, the National Science Foundation, the authority had been transferred to the Department of Commerce, set up ICANN, Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, to administer three specific areas: names, numbers, and protocols. And they set up supporting organizations for each. The protocol supporting organization was the IETF. And the domain name supporting organization, the DNSO, that's what it's called, was set up to work with the issue of domain names, the domain name spaces. How do we deal with the demand? How do we deal with the demand not only for names but for new top-level domains? How do we resolve issues of copyright, trademark, right to trademark, and so on? Yet all of this is under the U.S. Department of Commerce. The U.S. Department of Commerce has to approve major things that ICANN does. So ICANN is trying to be a world government for the internet, but in fact it's controlled by the U.S. government. Now the fact is the U.S. government is going to control it in such a way that we think it's going to be relatively beneficial for the internet, but the world may not believe that. International organizations are circling around like Indians on the prairie. The ITU is in the lead. They would very much like to see internet administration be in their province. They're an international organization. They're concerned with telecommunications. For many years, they poo-pooed the internet. They didn't see it as important. Now they realize they missed the boat, they would like to get their hand in to stir the pot. Also, in 1998, the U.S. Department of Commerce went through a series of discussion papers, a green paper and a white paper. And I don't remember these things really into the detail. Rhonda does, and she remembers them well and accurately. What came out of that were some competing proposals for what this ICANN should look like and what its charter should be. And one of the strong elements in
I think Rhonda's proposal, as well as maybe one other, was that ICANN, whatever it is, should have individual members. That is, what is the governance of the administering body of the Internet? Should it be one person from each nation? Should it look like the ITU but not be the ITU? How do you set up something like this, from which is essentially...
You're saying that ICANN at large was a direct result of Rhonda's agitation?
No. I'm saying that there were Rhonda, I know, and I think one other proposal argued strongly that ICANN should be governed by a board of directors, some or all of which were elected by individuals. That is, ICANN should be a membership organization, mm-hmm. like the Women's Voice.
The phrase of bottom up.
Yeah, totally bottom up.
It was in 98 when that was really conceived.
I believe so, and I think you need to look at the there were four proposals put forward for governance of ICANN, I believe it was the summer of 98, which was the contentious summer when all this happened. That was also the summer of 98 when the initial directors were chosen, I've forgotten my dates. It was a little bit before then, when it was John Postel, who was widely regarded and respected as being the person who could pull this off, if anybody could pull it off. He had the temerity to die after the initial directors had been selected by him. So there was always a question of the legitimacy of that first choice of directors. And I remember being in Geneva in 1998 when this was, and in Boston in late 98 when Rhonda was there, and she was first at the mic. And the attackers of ICANN, the people who felt that their model had not been chosen, came up, and I remember Rhonda's first statement was, "This is the beginning of the death of the one of the best ideas that mankind has ever spawned," and so on and so forth. Now, the problem is, in what sense were these new directors legitimate? John Postel had chosen them, then he had died. Where was the individual membership base? Let's see. But I want to take this.
I would say on time that, I mean, we kind of know that there are the arguments, there are basic arguments that are going on now, which are whether there should be an authoritative root server, who can control it, and, those two. That's what I'd like to hear.
Okay. Well, you know then that there was an... ICANN decided to have individual members. This was under pressure from the U.S. government, I believe, they started taking applications in May, June. They closed the books for election, I think, in September or October. The election was held in November. If you looked at the distribution of individual members, first of all, anybody could join. You look at the distribution of individual members, you'll find that of the 75,000 that voted, 15,000 of them came from Japan. I'm sorry, of the 100,000 that were registered.
It's about because the thing happened in Yokohama and there was a high awareness in Japan. Right?
No. 15,000 came from Japan, 20-some thousand came from Korea, a few thousand came from China. There was such a maldistribution of members. In Yokohama, we were told, we heard rumors, and I can't substantiate them, that there were organized campaigns in Japan to get people to join ICANN. So what you have is, in effect, an electronic nationalism asserting itself, that if ICANN is important, then we want our votes, we want our voice to be heard. There's nothing wrong with that, in theory. What happens is that you go back to block voting by country. If you look at how many people are ICANN members here? Two of us.
I'm on this review group, but I'm not, the reviewing the working group, but...
Yeah,
I looked at it and said, "Well, this is an extraordinary thing because really nationalism is not what matters. They're having to hammer out these new constituencies based on basic interests that are regardless. I mean, this is the first time where there's ever been constituencies that are not based on geography, purely based on whether you're an individual, a non-profit, or a commercial."
Yeah.
Or a
The thing is that the way in which membership, the way in which people are going to apply for membership in ICANN is going to, my sense is, it's going to be relatively independent of the importance of the internet to them. The fact is, we have only a few. We have 7,000 members in the United States and 20,000 members in Korea. What sense does that make? Even if I grant you that voting is by area, geographic region, so the fact there are 20,000 Koreans doesn't affect the vote in North America. But I think what we will see is that ICANN individual membership will become a way for nations to reassert themselves in ways that are neither really productive nor indicative of the true interests of the administration of the internet. I think what we lack, and this is something.
You think there's got to be a train wreck before anything changes? Then?
I don't know. Maybe. I think what we lack is a way of implementing cyber democracy. We know how to do democracy more or less with existing institutions, although it's representative democracy. It's not everybody, all 250 million of us in this country, getting in one room and voting. We administer by representation. What we don't have are ways of taking this grassroots phenomenon, this bottom-up phenomenon, and making cyber democracy. If you look at my example is the newsgroups. Rhonda Hauben thinks the newsgroups are a good model for cyber democracy. The newsgroups that I read, which are at all contentious, are generally taken hostage by a few people, half of whom hate the other half. And you have opposing views, and particularly I'm thinking of the NCDNHC, or the NCC, I forget what it's called now, the not-for-profit group that that is part of this panoply of ICANN organizations. And that group has been hijacked. The nonprofit organizations belong to the group. There are 41 Korean out of 180 some organizations, 41 are Korean. None of the organizations I would consider important in the not-for-profit community are there. I actually joined NYU to the consortium, and then I withdrew it because I felt that they were not productive, and I didn't want them representing the university. What you have is spamming. And the analogy I like to use is what we have in cyberspace now is the electronic equivalent of Hyde Park, with thousands of soapboxes and people standing around, but with some fundamental differences. At Hyde Park, you can see how many people are listening, and you can see how many people are heckling. On the internet, you can't. And so what you have in its place are people who have lots of time, who can type quickly, who are articulate, or who people think are articulate. It's like time at the mic. They grab the mic, you can't see who's there, and they monopolize the conversation. And so and you have this anonymous voice, and because they're speaking all the time and nobody's contradicting them, you think, this person must have a following. Well, maybe they do and maybe they don't, but who knows? But the effect of this of what appears to be polarization as opposed to coming together is that the news group gets hijacked, the vocal folks grab it, nobody else participates, they drift off, nobody wants to participate, and so you have the potential appearance of legitimacy, but not the actual fact of legitimacy. And this, just following the Hyde Park example, one more statement and I'll close. Somebody said to me when I gave them that example, they said, right, and now you know why Parliament doesn't meet in Hyde Park.
Right.
So the governance issue, I claim the individual membership category never should have been created until we understand how to implement cyber democracy.
This group that I was on, I mean, it had no power. All it was doing was reviewing the work of the group and feeding back and having it like an advisory board. And then on this BAI thing that we're working on, we're seeing, you know, that the national board is going top down, and so people are arguing for bottom up and saying the whole thing was, the foundation thing was bottom up. But what we're seeing is that people are forming like groups and lists and all mailing lists. I mean, there's 25 different mailing lists, and there are certain ways now where the ability to form a group, and not just, you're not confined to the Usenet, you can form a group of your own and you can spin off.
Absolutely.
And so the whole thing's a bit more. And then also, one of the responses to Rhonda was, I remember, on a discuss group, was that someone pointed out that nothing had been done democratically. You know what I mean? That IETF was not a democratic. And you know, looking at sort of at Vint, right, it's interesting because he's an engineer. And so, I mean, this whole business, I mean, if you look at how Ethernet was developed, to like, you've got this common space and people are colliding, so you've got to have some way of dealing with people colliding. It's an engineering problem. And to me, it's very fascinating to see great engineers apply themselves to the social problems, being forced to, in order to make their network work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right now.
Yep.
I don't know, a question or thought or an observation or something. It seems to me that the issue is education and this stuff. And you sort of pursued the distance education. There seems to me as a, we'll use the word niche, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a niche, as you said, of correspondence courses have had a long, long history. And whether or not, you know, people are going to succeed at that, it seems to me that's not the interesting use of this technology, particularly. I mean, I have no objection to any of that. And I've read that somebody in Thailand took a course in something, you know, from New York Institute of Technology, and wonderful, I think, you know, why not? But in Thailand, in Bangkok, there are schools with children today that have joint history projects with two or three schools in other parts of the world. I know personally a Thai teacher who works in that school. She uses it to nurture written language when you write for an audience in a distant country, to seek to get cooperative partnership or to develop a different perspective on the history of that country, wherever the other school is, and Thailand. And so the kids in Thailand learn from children in another part of the world, and they practice their English in that case, because I don't think kids in Canada read Thai particularly. So, but that's all right, too. But it seems to me that projects like that make possible dialogue, conversation, sense of community with kids in different parts of the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems to me that's magical and important. It would provide an opportunity to for some communication from that tiny island with, you know, people in other parts of the world. And it turned out the teacher got sick or something, and a parent brought two girls to youth camp. And I had a long talk with the parent. And the parent was sort of touched by the reality that on Norfolk Island, as tiny as less than 1,000 population of the island, they could communicate with kids in other parts of the world. In New York, and actually they came here, but they also had partnerships in Europe. And it's sort of a way of networking young people around the world, globally, whatever kind of metaphor you want to use for that. You know, it isn't like 1 to 1,000, it's just partner schools here and there. And I think that's a very important use, much more important. And if we could teach teachers how to nurture that with their kids, you know, with whatever. Mm-hmm. There's a, it's sort of a poignant, I met the teacher, I once had a video phone call with my class. It was an old Uma phone with this teacher in Brooklyn. But the teacher's project was at the time of the Somalian episode. And he had kids in Brooklyn compare the violence in Brooklyn with the violence in Somalia. And they wrote to each other about that. And that was the subject of their classroom exercises. I thought that was interesting and creative.
Yeah, it's an entirely different use of, yeah, of education.
It's collegiate use, really.
Collegial, yeah.
And it's, again, I'll come back to this BAI thing, where it's very, where the national board are cutting off the listeners and firing people and shutting people out. And what I said to them last week is, what they're going to find is that they cannot shut out the internet. The internet will not get shut out. And we're seeing that, you know, there's far more discussion of the issues of all this thing going on the internet than there is in the public meetings, than there is on the boards, as far as in the, you know, and in the committees, where people,
absolutely,
and the same kind of business where you're saying, well, some people are mouthing off and flaming and other people are doing it, but between the thing, there is, it's there and it's reviewable, and it, you know, the next person can come along and go through it, and there is consensus coming out, you know, being having to be hacked out of it all. it's a change of process, and I think the people in the middle, they don't get it. You know what I mean? They just look at the internet as somewhere where, you know, opinion masquerading as fact, you know, don't believe anything you read. Yeah. They're not understanding this process that's going on.
But we need something to eliminate the problems that we now have in cyberspace discourse. We need an etiquette which people will subscribe to, which provides for progress.
It's something that I feel is that a lot of it, people are using hammers to screw in screws, and that things like, you know, mailing lists or Usenet are not absolutely suited to certain things, and this is why people come up with stuff like, say, Slashdot, where people can moderate stuff. And I think some of it, especially on email, is down to the original stuff where they could have had a better form of tagging your mail and being able to filter it within your mail so that you can say, okay, this is, I am writing a bunch of rubbish here, and you can tag it, rubbish. And everybody can say, filter rubbish. And you see what I mean? like the Pix format.
I want one of those.
That's what my company does, but no one's doing it.